greetings to everyone tuning in from around the world. My name is Cody Urban, talking to you from Portland, Oregon in the United States.
Hi, Cody. Hi, everyone. Greetings from Manila, Philippines. I am Mench, also your host for this premiere episode of the People's Struggle podcast, brought to you by the International League of People's Struggle.
And the International League of People's Struggle, or ILPS, is an international united front organization of around 400 mass organizations in about 45 countries and territories around the world. We bring together our organizations on shared analysis and shared action through conferences, publications, campaigns, and convergences that uplift our shared fights against the global imperialist system.
That's right, Cody. So as part of these efforts, and as we strive to foster greater solidarity and collective awareness across borders, we are thrilled to introduce this exciting new podcast series. Join us as we delve deep into the topic of imperialism, exploring its manifestations in our everyday lives. Hopefully through this, we can share and build a deeper understanding of the struggles we face. So we welcome you all to a thought-provoking journey of cultural exploration. You know, the first time, Cody, I heard the term imperialism, it was just too much for me to take. It's such a, you know, I always thought it was a very complicated term, a very complicated concept. But, you know, in our everyday lives, even before we know it, it's being manifested in our culture, everyday life, the type of content or media we consume. So that is what we are going to talk about today. And for us to examine the thoughts that stem from this deliberate influence exerted through us, through the pervasive messages we encounter daily, the contents we consume, the TV shows we watch, the series we watch, the films we watch, it extends beyond the news we read. And as imperialism, it seeps through these types of content. And I'm very excited to talk about this topic, specifically on how imperialism and also the concept of militarism is being normalized in everyday television show, especially here in the Philippines, Cody. A lot of TV shows really are featuring or humanizing, so to speak, lives of state forces, police officers. And it's really dangerous how these types of ideas or thoughts are being conveyed to the public or to the wider Filipino audience and even in other parts of Asia.
Right. And I think one thing that's really important about the word militarism is that it's not, you know, war, like people actually fighting each other. Militarism goes so beyond that. What are the things that make us accept that war is inevitable? What are the things that teach us, like you're saying, in our day-to-day lives, in the cultural sphere, that we have to buy into war? That's kind of like the subtle things about militarism that play out in our pop culture that I think if we don't understand how they play out, we're all going to like be caught up in that militaristic kind of way of thinking. So I think this is super important.
So if you have any ideas or you'd like to hear in future programs, please email us at peoplespodcast@ilps.info and let us know your ideas. Let's start. As I was saying a while ago, Cody, we often like encounter the term imperialism, militarism, but in our day-to-day life, it sinks into our culture. So today we will look at the entertainment media such as movies, video games, even advertisements, and even social media to pinpoint the ways that we all become cultural consumers of imperialism's logic of military expansion. And you were right when you said that it's not just about people fighting, it's not just about bombs and the likes, but it seeps in through some media platforms. So here in the Philippines, Cody, I'm not so sure if you've noticed it or if it reaches you on your side of the world, but there has been a long emerging trend of Philippine TV shows and films featuring the lives of a police officer or a military officer. And it focuses, like the story, the plot focuses on the personal life of that police or military officer, his love interest, his personal struggles. Actually, I remember when I was a child, when I still used to watch television. Now it's really not a part of my everyday routine anymore. But as a family, we used to watch, we call it teleserye. it's being aired at night, during the night. And then it's always like that. And growing up, and when I already got to, you know, familiarize myself deeper on specific social issues of the day, so you realize it's really like a long time platform being utilized by the government and even the state forces to romanticize the life of these police officers or these military officers, while at the same time, the dangerous part is hiding into the background, the actual social political issues that are related to our state forces. So here in the Philippines, for instance, one concrete example of these kinds of shows or this type of trend in Philippine TV shows is the TV show titled Ang Probinsyano. Are you familiar with it, Cody?
Yeah, I actually was in the Philippines a few years ago, as it was, I mean, it was big. I watched it every every night. I'm still working on my Tagalog, but, you know, I could definitely, it's like the same kind of police drama action TV show that I would always see in the US, but, you know, translated into a Philippine context, of course. But I totally remember Ang Probinsyano.
Yep. What's tricky there is it has something in its formula that really, you know, hooks the audience, like the Filipino family, especially the young ones. When the Probinsyano aired, I think it has aired for like more or less 8 years, was able to, you know, run and pass through two administrations, I think, two Philippine governments. And there was this one time when we were immersing in a community here in Mindanao, and I was discussing with kids of farmers. I was it was through an extension program with my mother. I was a tag along. I asked the children what they wanted to be when they grow up. And like, this is without exaggeration, almost 80% of those kids idolize Cardo Dalisay, who is the main character of the Ang Probinsyano. Everyone wanted to be a policeman when they grew up.
Yeah. And that makes sense, because in the show, he's presented as like this hero of the people. You know, he's actually, in fact, he's a police officer who kind of seems a little anti-police at times, and so what I mean.
Yeah, and of course it's one of the most watched action dramas in the Philippines, the longest running TV show drama in the Philippines, and of course the lead actor of the series is Coco Martin, one of the most famous actors here in the Philippines. And actually,
right, who doesn't want to be Coco Martin?
Right, and actually he was the one who originally proposed the idea of making a television show. It was actually adapted from a film, Ang Probinsyano, by the late action star Fernando Poe Jr. So it goes all the way back. It was not really an original, but, you know, the story Ang Probinsyano was from a years-long film by Fernando Poe Jr., who's also like a longtime and a classic action star in the Philippines. Some quick facts about the Ang Probinsyano. I was really curious about how this show made it to like 8 long years. The actors actually of Ang Probinsyano went through a boot camp training at the National Police. They went through a boot camp training at the Philippine National Police Academy in order for them to perform the policeman roles better, to make it more like, you know, real, and to reflect the actual, you know, police behavior, demeanor, whatever you call it. And you were right. There are some scenes or there are some episodes that they are not really totally pro-police. Like, they also show the bad side of the police, of the institution, to make it more, you know, realistic. So they also actually cut their hair like the real policemen, even when they were not really required to do that. So it's really an intensive preparation for the show. Actually, because of that, the lead actor, Coco Martin, he actually said that being considered as a role model, even of the Filipino youth, is one of the most touching comments he received because of this show. And, you know, what's even crazier, Cody, is that this lead actor, Coco Martin, has been awarded a certificate of appreciation by the Philippine Criminal Investigation and Detection Group, or the CIDG, on its 63rd anniversary for his devoted portrayal as a police officer in the show.
Right. So it has the blessings. It's got the blessings of the agency yeah. every step of the way, even at the times that it's trying yeah. to be a little anti-agency
yeah.
just to yep. get people, you know, again, the people who are most affected by police, you know, people living in poverty, people who are out of a job, who have to do in order to survive, oftentimes have to find work on the streets or, you know, for whatever reason, end up on the other side of a policeman's gun because, yeah. you know, so of course the only way to get those people to be less anti-police is to give them a buy-in to a show and then have the anti-police person say, but I'm a police officer and yep. here's why that's okay.
And I think that's also one of the reasons why the show really like lasted for 8 long years, since it really has like a priority time, during the for the shows in one of the largest media corporation here in the country. And even during the pandemic, it actually, you know, really thrived still. And I think one of the strategies that the creators and the producers of the show really did was, at the end of the day, people will still tend to the policeman as their savior, as their superhero. So actually, I noticed there was also a time that I tried to really understand. So I watched a few episodes of Ang Probinsyano. That was during the Duterte administration. It was the height of his drug war campaign. It was already being condemned in other countries. And a lot of groups, a lot of organizations, and even institutions, human rights organizations in the Philippines and in the other countries are like condemning the war on drugs. In the Ang Probinsyano, they are also adjusting the issues that they tackle based on the actual political situation. So I noticed that there's this one episode that they will portray poor people who are, you know, most of the time victims of the drug war. So that's real, that's true. But at the end of the day, they will also show how the policemen, some policemen are bad, but the analysis there is not all cops are bad. So it's not really, you know, targeting the Philippine National Police as an institution and how it is being utilized by the Duterte government for his flagship campaign on the war on drugs. It didn't just happen during the Duterte administration. Even before, there is almost always one specific Filipino drama show that would humanize a police or military officer. And it's almost always intertwined with the actual political or, you know, political issue or situation in the Philippines.
I think that what's really important about this is that, again, going back to militarism, you know, what's the culture yeah. that justifies war? And we're talking about police, you know, we're talking about the war on drugs, like you were saying. I mean, that is a war. That is a literal, you know, bloody yeah. war on the streets of any country through which there is yeah. a so-called war on drugs, which of course was tagged, you know, in my own country, in the United States, and has just been exported around the world. But part of that, you know, we have our own, you know, I'm just making me think in the US, as I was growing up in the 90s, the show that was, I never watched it, but I always, you know, the other, you know, kids I went to school with are always talking about Cops. Like there's this show called, this literally just called Cops in the US. And this TV camera follows around real cops as they're arresting real people. And they're almost always Black. They're always poor. Yeah. You know, it continues the racist and, you know, anti-working class stereotype and just bias that goes into all kinds of, you know, policing and militarism. And the cops are just totally shown as like these, you know, crass, you know, cold. They're joking about, you know, kicking these guys in the face, you know, that they seem awful, you know, and yet, you know, at the time, you know, people are still buying into that. Fast forward to today, and especially in the context of the Philippines, where, you know, the police are, you know, especially in the countryside, right, are, you know, practically like paid off private death squads at times. If you yeah. can't hide it in the same way. And so what do you have to do? You can't just show the, you know, the super like macho policeman unmasked and cruel, but maybe you can show the super macho policeman seeming to be a little less cruel to at least get your foot back in the door, and then again tell you, but it's okay, I'm a police officer. And so, yeah, there's some bad police officers, but the police is ultimately good. And that's sort of, I think, this new age of getting people to buy in to ultimately bloodthirsty militaristic institution like the police that is just there to protect the ruling system. But it's subtle. It's making us subtly support it without us realizing it.
That's right. That is so. That was a very, very great point, Cody. Like you mentioned, even years ago, it was almost like a black and white thing. Like the police are bad, military are bad. Every time there's a mention of police or military, even in the countryside here in the Philippines, the initial and automatic feeling to that is fear. Now, through the past few years and through the past administrations, especially during the peak of the Duterte administration, it seems like even TV shows, huge media corporations and huge shows, they have also found a way to adjust and to cater to the human side of these institutions, of these officers. That's why a lot of young people, young Filipinos, even the children, the kids, 4 to 5 to 6 years old, at a very young age, they really idolize these types of, police officers like the Cardo de Lisay of Ang Probinsyano, since it's more humanized. And you're right when you said it, it's very subtle, it's not like before that it's a black and white thing, that the automatic feeling that you'll, feel is fear, and you're going to hide if there's a policeman. Now they are trying to change the trajectory that so people would believe that whenever there's a policeman or a military officer, the initial feeling should be you're secured, you're protected. And that's really dangerous considering everything that has been happening, not just during the Duterte administration, but even up to the current Marcos Jr. administration that's transitioning now, since the drug war is still here. It's still going on. There's no specific legislation or action points or policies of the current Marcos administration that really firmly stands against the drug war.
And even here in the US, one of the largest, actually, I was looking at the numbers, I think, of people who came out for this, but in the United States, just, I think it's going on like almost 3 years ago now, as of yet, the largest combined meaning everyone out on the streets at the same time. Previously, the largest ever protest in the United States history was against the Iraq war, the invasion of U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. But that record was broken in 2020, where the largest ever protest in U.S. history was to condemn the racist murder of George Floyd here in the U.S., who was a poor Black man who was murdered. It was many people refer to it as a modern day lynching by a white police officer who just, sat there with his knee on, like, being pushed down into his neck as he died, saying, "I can't breathe." And, so this issue of, this isn't just police violence. This is police warfare. This is class warfare. Right. And it's racial class warfare here in the US, especially. And so this is on so many people's minds in the US, in the Philippines. And so it also makes me think what you're saying, despite the fact that, it's dangerous, it's a sign that the capitalists and their states, the imperialist powers are seeing they have to get creative in order to get us, to get regular people, to get the masses behind their programs and to support them. So that's kind of scary. It's a new thing we're up against, but it also shows that they know that they can't ignore us anymore. They can't ignore the people. So if anything, Ang Probinsyano is just an example of how strong the people's movement in the Philippines has been, that it has actually forced the hand of imperialist media institutions and the police to be like, whoa, what do we do here? And then you have to rehash it into this new thing. That new thing wasn't just on them to create. I think the important thing is it's also because of people fighting back and organizing that, you know, the oppressors also are forced to change. And I think that's just, that's such an important thing for ILPS organizations and for anyone fighting for a better future to see, is that, you know, we have the power to force change. And in fact, we're forcing change every single day.
You know, as the forms of these types of governments and state forces are really like emerging and it's getting stronger. On the other side of the fence, you know, people's movements are also getting stronger, right? So we have seen it, especially during the height of the pandemic. And also, of course, like what you've mentioned, there have been a series of protests about relevant issues. And it's not just, for instance, the Black Lives Matter movement, which highlighted not just the police brutality, but also state brutality in general. It influenced a lot of movements and people's resistance, even in other parts of the world, even extending to Asia and even in the Philippines. So are there any like parallel shows or science fiction or whatever content there in the US that also, you know, shows the same format or strategy of this kind of emerging militarist trend?
Yeah, I knew you were gonna ask because I'm such a fantasy and sci-fi nerd. So that's my thing that I grew up on all the time. And of course it's like your release, your escape, right, from the real world is to dive into fantasy, you know, something that just could not happen. Like there's no way that Lord of the Rings could really happen in real life. So when I'm tired or scared of real life, where am I going to go? I'm going to go to Lord of the Rings and just forget about everything with real life, just for a little bit, to escape for a bit. But that's why fantasy and science fiction is also a tool when it's in the hands of the ruling class and it's in the hands of, you know, oppressive state media. Because again, just like on Pope and Sean now, that's its own kind of release, right? It takes place in a society where the things you seek are really happening. But it's also, you know, the characters are just actors, can play around with reality. And so it makes you feel like you're in a different, you're not living in the world you're actually in. But because of that, we can forget that what we're actually seeing is reproductions of what's in the real world. So even when we're escaping, it reminds us what we have to take as normal for real. And my big example, I want to talk about that. It's actually not in the US. Well, it is. I'll get there. But have you ever seen Godzilla?
I'm familiar with it. When I was a child, I think I've seen it, but I never really, you know, I've never been drawn to it, you know, just maybe my cousins, the boys, but I'm not really into it.
Got it. Yeah, I saw almost every Godzilla movie growing up. Here's a wild thing that I didn't really know until recently. Mensch, what if I told you that Godzilla was supposed to be an anti-war movie?
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
Yeah. So here's the story. So Godzilla was directed by this guy Ishiro Honda in Japan, and it was directed not that long after World War II ended. In fact, I think it was 1954. So this is not even a decade after World War II ended. Now, of course, in Japan, how did World War II end? I mean, Japan was one of the imperialist powers of the Axis, right? I mean, the Japanese government and military just led a vicious and like near genocidal campaign throughout Asia Pacific to try so that its ruling class could try and, you know, squeeze up its own colonies. And it was devastating and horrific for the people around the region. But of course, the response of the United States, which was on a war path to make sure that it would be the most powerful superpower at the end of the war, what was its response? It dropped the only two nuclear bombs ever used against people. The only time nuclear weapons have ever been used in warfare were by the United States. It was like, again, it's something that could be considered an act of genocide just with the push of a button and in the time frame of a split second, depending on how many nuclear bombs you're intending to use. And so this was the Japanese people, common everyday people who were, you know, brought along through, you know, their own cultural institutions of militarism, like what we're talking about now. People in the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were literally just disintegrated. It's one of the most horrific acts of warfare that has ever been used. And so, go for it.
I was just about to say, what's funny is the recent, you know, G7 summit. Do you want to talk about it, Cody? Since it's in Hiroshima, right? You were there.
Yeah. And so one thing that I saw, we went there with our campaign against the G7 summit that this year was happening in Hiroshima, Japan.
Yeah.
And when the bomb hit in Hiroshima and it just leveled all these different buildings, there was one building that still stood, and it was like almost miraculous that it was still standing. I mean, it was like the windows were exploded out, and, you know, the building, you know, was weathered a lot, but it still stood amidst this desert of rubble. And so when Hiroshima was rebuilt, that building was kept as it is. It wasn't, you know, prettied up or anything, because it was meant to be a memorial, a reminder to the horrors of nuclear war. And it's at the Hiroshima Peace Park now. And so when we, you know, members from ILPS and other organizations went to join the protests against this G7 summit in Hiroshima, this is a summit of, you know, the US and its strongest allies, you know, yeah, that make up the US, you know, nuclear arsenal, you know, this slap in the face to the people of Hiroshima.
Yeah. It's actually almost disgusting, right?
Yeah.
To hold it in Hiroshima.
Yeah. And when I went by that building and actually saw that building standing there still in its same form as when the bomb dropped, what I saw was this wall of police in front of it. You have these police officers who have literally barricaded a peace memorial. What does that mean when the ruling class, the major powerful imperialist governments, are meeting at a peace memorial to plan further war moves, and yet they've barricaded it, not allowing regular citizens to come visit it? It's like peace has itself become a weapon. And that's another important thing for us to realize, too. And there's a way that this same thing of peace being a weapon has continued to be used subtly, right, in our pop culture that we see, whether it's biopics or real life dramas, or whether it's fantasy and science fiction like Godzilla. And of course, there's a lot more to talk about. We're coming up at the end of our time. So maybe we should revisit it. But I think that just that image I want to leave with everyone of a peace memorial that is being barricaded by police while the heads of state of the most war-hungry militaristic governments are meeting just around the block at that same site. So we should know how these things about peace, these words of peace, are used to drive us, to allow us to accept pushes for more warfare from the powerful. So maybe that's something else for our organizations to think about, you know?
Yeah, you know what, Cody? Actually, I just realized from Ang Probinsyano to Godzilla, we were able to talk about a lot of things and a lot of concepts that seem like, very theoretical to when I was younger, it was very like, it was very vague for me. But now we can actually talk about it and relate it to our everyday lives. And I'm particularly interested with your Godzilla story. So now, while we reach the tail end of this podcast, I'm gonna have to do my research about Godzilla, since it's interesting to me that it was originally like an anti-war film, and there are a lot of representations there, since it's also like, being drawn from a historical point of view. It was the bombing in Nagasaki was just fresh that time. So I think I'm gonna nerd out on Godzilla for the next few days.
Yes, do your homework and nerd out, Minch. Everyone watching.
I'm very excited for the continuation of our discussion on Godzilla and how, militarism and imperialism are manifested in everyday pop culture, not just in the Philippines, not just in the US, but in the other parts of the world. Cody, I would just like to thank you again. And thank you for the listeners for joining us on this first episode of the People's Struggle podcast on the complex relationship between militarism, mass media, and pop culture. And we hope that this premiere episode of the podcast has provided you with a valuable insight and a deeper understanding of how these forces intertwine in shaping our world today.
Thank you, Mensch. And again, just, this is just one example of us, of organizers, of, anti-imperialists trying to break down the what's hidden, is hidden in plain sight usually, that allows for imperialism, militarism to still keep going on. But of course, it's all of our tasks, right? This is just one way we can do it. We want to hear from you. We want to hear about how you're doing this. We want to hear about how you are breaking down these complex issues and how you are exposing what is happening, in the day-to-day lives of the people to show how, this is actually part of the fight we have to do. This is part of our fight against militarism by breaking this down. Because, what could a more pro-people culture look like? And that's also one of the things that we want to be covering on this show is not just, exposing and tearing down the bad. We want to also be uplifting what does an alternative really look like. And so we hope that if you're willing to talk about that, you'll also get back in touch with us. Menchie, what is that email address again so that people can get back in touch with us?
Please email us at peoplespodcast@ilps.info if you have comments, suggestions, and any questions about the program. And please send us more suggestions about the topics and struggles you would like us to address, or even some specific, guests that you would want us to have for this podcast. You can also stay tuned through our website, peoplesstruggle.info, and you can also search the official social media pages and platforms of the ILPS. We are also on Facebook and we are also on Twitter. So there you can also, to our new audiences, they can read our statements on specific issues of international relevance that highlight the people's struggles of different countries and movements. And we also have the ongoing campaigns being updated there regularly. This is Mensch from the ILPS.
And this is Cody.
All right. So thank you very much for your attention, and we wish you continuing success in your anti-imperialist and democratic struggles for justice and liberation. Thank
Thanks,
you, everyone.
everyone. Talk to you next time. Long live international solidarity.